Let's move forward.
All right, we'll just slate this. This is Henry Butler for Heavenly Sight. Henry, when you were born and your family realized that you were not going to be sighted, how did that affect their expectations for you?
Judging from my conversation with my mom, she decided that she needed to get going. Remember that this was a time in the South when it was hard for black males especially to get an education, and it was hard, it's harder for black blind males to realize an education, or at least realize getting into school on time. Well, my mom used to tell me how she would look for the right people to talk to and that kind of thing, and all of the rehab counselors were white people in the South, white men in the South, which made it even more difficult to try to reach them, to try to talk to them. But she kept doing the, she kept working on it and kept, trying to call people. And she finally got with somebody and they told her about the school in Baton Rouge. And actually there were two schools in Baton Rouge. There was a school for Caucasian or white blind people, and as the Louisiana people used to say, a school for colored blind people. And I went to the latter. It turns out that that school wound up being a better school educationally. We wound up having more certified teachers. Teachers who got their degrees from Big Ten schools, their advanced degrees from Big Ten schools, and their certification from schools out of state, because most of those teachers really couldn't get into the LSU system because of the color barriers. So I think, judging from all of the conversations that I've had with my mom, she realized that she didn't have time to wait on anybody to do anything, and she just got out and started looking for people and started doing things.
So in a way, when your mother was confronted with these white male rehabilitation specialists, was kind of the beginning of the clash of expectations. She had one level set. My guess is they had a simpler future plotted out.
Well, that's very true, actually. one guy, when I was a junior in high school, brought me in and we did a battery of tests. And he told me, he said, you know, you did very well on your tests, and especially the reasoning part, the whatever that meant. And then he said, but I'd like to see you do something with your hands. Rather than going to college, I'd rather see you be a piano tuner. Now, this is a guy, he's probably close to his retirement, and this was in 1965, beginning of 66, something like that. I was graduating from the high school in 66, thinking about going to college. But he was trying to sway me from that, and it was typical of what white males would do in Louisiana, try to get you to go to a trade school, or try to get you to take some menial job versus trying to get an advanced education. So that kind of thing, you know, black people, and especially black blind or visually impaired people, faced for many, many decades in the South.
When you got to the Baton Rouge, Louisiana school for, at the time, colored blind children, you finally found some people who are ready to adjust expectations up. What was that like?
Well, these people, and that's why I love those teachers, because they made us work harder. They understood that we had to work twice as hard in an environment, in the kind of environment that we were in. They realized that you had to supersede most white blind people to get anywhere in the South, and in many cases in the North. So they stayed on us. It was like tough love almost all the time. It was hard to take sometimes, you know. But we had all these blind people had gone out of state and gotten their degrees and came back into state and taught these kids with care, with the understanding that it's not easy out there, especially in those days it wasn't easy. Most of my class and most of the classes in the years that I was there wound up sending kids to college. And then, of course, after getting to college and graduating, and even if you did well, then the state wouldn't hire you. And that was before, you know, it was long before the ADA and long before any laws were on the books that meant that they had to deal with, you know, equal opportunity kinds of things.
Now, you'll forgive my saying this, Henry, but I think that your career and personality has a lot to do with coloring outside the lines, as we say. You're a guy who likes to explore his own limits. I'm wondering, in the environment of the school for colored blind children, did this frighten a lot of people, or did this upset a lot of people? I mean, Henry doesn't want to just learn music. He wants to perform music. Henry doesn't want to just perform music. He wants to go out and work and perform music. A lot of it is benign. We don't want Henry to get hurt. We don't want Henry to get beyond himself. But a lot of it is benign condescension as well.
A lot of the older people who were, say, in administration at the school, I think felt like that. My mother didn't have a problem with me performing when I was 14. And they told her, well, now, you know, there's so many possibilities, so many disrupting possibilities that could happen. You know, your kid could have an accident out there, and, you know, this and that could happen. She said, and so they said, okay, if you want to permit him to perform, you need to send us a letter saying that, and eliminating us from what's the word they use?
Liability.
Yes, yes. So she did that, and of course, you know, the rest is history. I performed in professional bands and always had older people looking out for me. And I happened to be the one doing all the arranging in most of those bands, doing all the orchestration and that kind of thing. So, of course, you know, my mom was very happy once I graduated from high school with, you know, quite good grades and all that. I wasn't the valedictorian, but I was the salutatorian. And got into college, got into college after studying and taking college theory when I was in ninth grade, and So by the time I got to college, I was prepared to actually opt out of theory if they had given me a test. But because I was blind, they didn't want to do that. So I wound up having to sit through all these theory classes after studying that stuff 3 or 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years before I got to college.
Henry, when you were describing your track program, your summer ed program for blind and visually impaired children in New Orleans, you said blind and visually impaired children acquire a different information set from their sighted peers. Spell that out for me. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're forced to acquire learning a different set of learning skills. They have to internalize what they're learning probably more than most sighted kids. Sighted kids probably take their sight skill set for granted more than, I mean, obviously more than blind people take their hearing set of skills. We did an informal test or an informal survey, so to speak, on the way and the level of concentration in blind kids versus the level of concentration with sighted kids. And we discovered almost immediately with almost every blind student in that program that they were able to concentrate more deeply than most sighted kids. And they were able to focus more quickly than most of the sighted kids. Now, I'm not saying that that's scientific, but we discovered that after having this camp for quite a few years, and in almost every instance, maybe with a few exceptions among the sighted kids, we found that the concentration was better and was in force quicker.
Now, in terms of the input end, the pedagogical end, the mm-hmm. teaching end, mm-hmm. what's the answer to the so what question on that? Because blind children have these enhanced capabilities, what does that mean in terms of preparing to teach them?
Well, you use the strengths of each kid as you can perceive them, so that if a blind kid, or if any kid, has good concentration skills, there is a chance that you can get them to do certain things by themselves more easily. There's a possibility that you can even give them, say, more advanced modules. That's not always the case, and obviously there are exceptions to everything. But there's a chance that you can get them into a place where they can practice by themselves a little quicker than maybe some other kids who can't focus as well. I mean, there are all kinds of things that you can do, but when the teacher is capable of perceiving the strength of the kid fairly quickly, then the teaching can be accelerated.
Describe for me the track program. When did it run? And just describe the whole package to me.
We started the track program. We started camps for blind musicians, blind and visually impaired musicians, first in 1994 at the Missouri School for the Blind, and that school was in St. Louis. Our curriculum that first year was theory, And some people will say sight singing, and they'll laugh at that and say, how do you teach blind kids how to sight read? Well, you teach visually impaired people how to sight read, and you teach blind students how to finger read. So basically, blind kids may not ever be able to sight read because they can't see, but they certainly can read music and be able to follow it using their fingers, using the Braille system. And we also taught jazz history, jazz appreciation, and we had combos, and we all we also had, as a part of that program, a component where we brought in motivational speakers from the community to talk about, just doing, being the best you can be, that kind of thing, it was quite successful. We felt that we had some very good kids in that first year. I think we did it again at the Missouri school in 95, and then we brought it to the Indiana School for the Blind. Our aim was to keep it at a school for the blind because the message we wanted to send was that we were definitely targeting blind and visually impaired kids, and we wanted not only the kids to be involved, but we wanted teachers from those schools to be involved on a certain level. And we wanted the administration from those schools to realize the kinds of things that could be taught to people of that age. We had ages 12 to 19 in our camps from 94, from the years 94 through 2005. After the 96 camp in Indianapolis, I didn't do the camp for a while because my mom passed away and I was moving to New Orleans, resigning my job at Eastern Illinois University, and I was truly burned out on a lot of things. So I just thought I needed a break.
Can I pause right there? We just have